Thank you for listening to Psychedelic Parenting, a service of Awakening Families. If you like what you hear, consider a tax-deductible gift to this work through our fiscal sponsor, MAPS, or use one of our Amazon links when you're buying the things you need.
Want to share with their young people the grandeur and the glory that they are encountering.
What's really important is the felt presence of direct experience. We have to stop consuming our culture. We have to create culture. Create your own roadshow. Nexus of space and time, where you are now, is the most immediate sector of your universe.
Welcome once again to the psychedelicparenting.org podcast. I am your host, Jonathan. With me today is Kalindi E. Kalindi is the founder of the Tamarian Institute, an African martial arts studio in Hamtramck, Michigan, and he is also a well-known speaker on the subject of high-dose psilocybin and exploring the mushroom realms. I've been trying to get Kalindi on the show for quite some time, so I'm very excited to have him here today. Kalindi and I met for the first time in 2012 at Psychedamia in Philadelphia, and we're both from Michigan, so it's very good to have a fellow Michigander on the show today. So welcome, Kalindi.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure being on and get the chance to finally get on the show. It's been a while coming.
Yeah, definitely. Let's kind of dive in first. A story that I haven't heard from you before is I'd like to ask you to share with us the experience of your very first mushroom journey.
Well, I mean, I'm still processing my first journey, which was over 45 years ago, back in the early 70s. And, you know, it was a trip of epic proportions. It catapulted me into several realms of understanding that has basically been a way of how I view the world and how I look at things outside of this world. You know, I'm still processing. It was I took a lot more than was recommended, because at the time I didn't know how much it took, so I basically ate the whole bag of the food of the gods. And the thing was is that I had really no guide or shaman or rudder. Mm-hmm. You know, I know that in my martial arts practice I had different compounds that people didn't share the formulas of what they were. But after that trip, I knew that mushrooms had to be a part of it. Mm-hmm. And so in journeying, you know, to different worlds and other solar systems, which I experienced on the mushrooms that first time, it gave me a glimpse of what I would be doing, you know, with the rest of my life. Mm-hmm. You know, mushrooms were kind of scarce in Detroit at that particular time. I mean, there were things you could get on Plum Street down downtown Detroit at the time. That was kind of like the psychedelic street in the early 70s and things like that, where they had, you know, different things, mostly acid and mm-hmm. cannabis, of course, and stuff like that, when it was kind of obscure. In the Motor City, you know, mm-hmm. of course, heroin and things like that were available in, you know, in throughout the city. Mm-hmm. But if you wanted acid or something like that, you basically had to go to Plum Street. Mm-hmm. So I was fortunate enough for a friend of mine who journeyed to Oaxaca, and he would bring back mushrooms. You know, he would always share them with me. And that went on for a few years. Then there was a drought or a dry spell, of which it was difficult to get them. He sent a few specimens and honey, things like that. So I used to have what they call blue honey, but things became scarce. So I started on a journey to basically grow my own. So I did research, and for a while grew a lot of mold. And those people who were cultivators know that weed fungi proliferates in our environment. So if you don't have a sterile environment, or mm-hmm. at least a semi-sterile environment, you basically get contaminants. But mm-hmm. I breached the learning curve and started to grow my own, you know. And over the years, I would grow my own using the old rye technique, mm-hmm. In the psilocybin grower's guide and other works at the time. Mm-hmm. But, you know, it was a slow process and it was a tedious process. And when you really didn't have the equipment, it was difficult to grow the amount you wanted to grow at that time. Mm-hmm. But with the internet raised its head and information started to move faster. And then the PF technique, the psilocybin fanaticus technique, came about. It kind of made things a lot easier. But I'd already been delving into mycology for years before the PF tech came out. But mm-hmm. it definitely made things a lot easier and a lot less tedious mm-hmm. to deal with.
Yeah, the PF tech was my first introduction to mushroom cultivation, and it you know, I was lucky to come in that era, because I really never had a bad batch, because that technique is very good for cutting down on contaminants and stuff.
Yeah, I would order kits out of High Times, and sometimes it was successful, and many times they weren't. But, you know, like I said, it just took a while to learn the techniques of cultivation. And that basically put me in a position to where I had my own, and I could start to explore at higher and higher doses, you know, because it's, you know, it wasn't a lot of info, a lot of interest in mushrooms. They were kind of like the sidebar, even though they're the starting point, the jump off point for not only psychedelics in the modern era, with, of course, Gordon Wasson and others at that time, but also in the ancient world, they were the jump off point and the push forward of hallucinogens on the earth. So I try to do it the way the original folks did it when they first encountered mushrooms, and that mm-hmm. was just eat them and eat enough of them to get access to the things that you're trying to know and trying to experience. So, you know, it's been a good run, mm-hmm. The last 44 years or 45 years, whatever it's been.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, I know that you're the father of 13 children. Tell me a little bit about raising your children in the presence of the mushrooms.
Well, I mean, not all of my children have taken mushrooms. Many of them have, and you know, it being part of how they grew up, as far as the mushrooms being in the house and people talking about mushrooms and having mushroom meetings and all those different type of things, they grew up around it. So it wasn't a big deal. I think many of them think that, well, everybody's house had mushrooms in it because. Because that's how they grew up,
right?
And so their, you know, their cousins and other children in the family would be around, and you know, if we had different conferences and things like that, because we'd have our martial arts school, and we'd have martial arts conferences every year, and we have lectures on mushrooms. We talk about mushrooms and things like that, and they were just exposed. They were inculcated in that whole culture from birth, so mm-hmm. they didn't look at it as a big deal, you know. And I think of maybe some of them haven't tried it because, you know, there's always a rebellious streak in children in there,
right? Yes.
Some of them are, just because it's what mom and dad did, and they you know, they choose to, hey, well, you know, I'm living my life a different way. But they all use, you know, they're eventually the ones even that haven't tried it know that it's always available, and they, you know, usually they're, what they're doing is one by one rolling over to at least trying it. Some you have that delve deep into mushroom mystery. Others who just kind of stay on the periphery. If we have an outing or a car, you know, or something like that, and go out and everybody does mushrooms, maybe do about 5 grand, things like that, they'll do it. But, you know, have some who, like their father, push the envelope and move towards, you know, trying to see what this thing is all about. So growing up and being part of their life, you know, mushroom being in the house, no big deal. If you grow up with something and it's the house, it's like a carton of milk on the table. You know, if you grow up, somebody say, well, what do you think about the carton of milk on the table? They're like, well, it's a carton of milk. It's, you know, a carton of milk all of the day. We drink it. You know, we drink milk all the time, you know. not that my children ever had milk, but I'm just using that as an analogy.
Sure, definitely.
You know, something that's not a big deal. Something that's not a big deal because, you know, it's not a big deal to them because it's been in their face since they were born. So they don't look at it as something weird or outside of the norm. They, of course, being in the world themselves with children and houses and jobs and all the other things, see it now. It's like, whoa, we had mushrooms in our house all the time. So it's kind of different being there when they get spouses and things like that. And folks mention mushrooms, they say, well, we had that all the time. That wasn't a big deal to us. It was just part of our life.
Yeah.
You know, so that's, you know, that's how it basically deals with them. So some of them trip alone, and some of them only trip during groups and things like that. So although a couple have kind of like have adopted the mantle, you know, most of them are just you know, they just do it, you know, to in the social sense of a group setting and, you know, things like that.
And could just maybe as an example for our listeners who are looking for ways to introduce their own family members to these experiences, what would a typical first experience for one of your kids look like? How would you initiate them into this?
Well, I wait till they ask to be able to do it. And usually, if it's one of the girls, their mother or sisters would introduce them to it. If it's one of the boys, I would introduce them to it in a setting of basically alone in the dark without stimuli. But I'm in the, you know, in the house and in the environment in case, you know, need something or people can get overwhelmed. But they've all done, you know, done real well as far as that, because they were prepared, you know, in seeing that, okay, well, your father and your mother have done this all of the years of your life. They're not drug addicts. They still work and take care of us. They still, you know, clean the bathroom and take out the trash. Nobody's freaked out. You know, you haven't had any drug raids or anything like that going on. So, you know, they see it as something that's normal, not something that is out the way. It's not what people say on the, you know, the drug propaganda media push, you know, that, oh, here's your brain on drugs and things like that. They don't look at it. They don't look at it as a drug. They look at it mainly, you know, more like a herb, even though it's a fungi, but they look at it as a herb that is for, you know, for the mind and spirit rather than a drug like, you know, acetaminophen or one of the other things that people take from the pharmaceutical companies. you know, Prozac and Xanax,
right,
and all these other types of things.
Mm-hmm. One of the things,
so it's a different category for them.
Yeah, yeah. One of the things that you mentioned was that mushrooms were a part of martial arts conferences and stuff. I'm interested in hearing about the connection between mushrooms and the martial arts tradition in Africa.
Well, it's very secretive, but it's prevalent all through Africa. And it's not just Africa, it's Asia also, and mm-hmm. Southeast Asia. They all have their entheogens to go along with the higher levels of practice of martial arts.
Mm-hmm.
Even though people may think that, well, certain martial arts have a Buddhist connection, some martial arts have a Taoist connection, others are different systems, be it the Akan or the Yoruba or the Igbo or whichever, the Maasai, the Ndebele. They all have their entheogens, of which many are mushrooms, because mm-hmm. you have different ways of learning. In the African sense, you have a group or age set area where you learn, where all of the boys at a certain age, you know, between maybe 12 and 15, are gathered together, and they go to the bush and they learn the tenets of manhood and responsibility to the group and things like that. And this is where they're introduced to their entheogens. Mm-hmm. Some entheogens are introduced at a younger age than between 12 and 15, but generally a lot of times it's between 12 and 15.
Mm-hmm.
Others, you know, as soon as babies are born, they start introducing certain entheogens mm-hmm. to them by the mother putting it on the nipple, so that when the baby suckles, they get small doses of the particular entheogen that they have.
Mm-hmm.
This is in some places, not all, but martial arts practice to synergize the energy, you know, in places in Africa, they call it Jom or Chi or Mangani or Ka or Ki. As in China, they call it Chi, or in Japan, they call it Ki. This is a way to be able to actualize, be able to see and manipulate energy, because you're taking a practicing dose or a hunting dose. In other words, the hunter societies have entheogens that they use to go hunting, to be able to enliven the bush, to be able to see better, and mm-hmm. things like that.
Mm-hmm.
And even things like Iboka or Ibogaine. You know, I know people talk about the large doses, which are the doses that a person would get maybe only once in a lifetime, that breaks open the head. Now, that's a dose that is a dose that you take that's so large and you eat over 3 days that it takes you to the brink of death. You almost, you take enough to kill yourself with that dose.
Mm-hmm.
But there are other doses that people take throughout their lifetime that are for other things.
Hmm.
Mandrills, or the great apes, before the males fight or do battle over a female or whatever, what they do is they go to the Iboka bush or the Ibogaine bush,
mm-hmm.
and they start eating the Ibogaine to gain that ferocity and fighting skill from the bush before they go into battle. And it's no different than the human, that these are not just things that are used for medicinal reasons, whether it's to get off of opioids or things like that in modern times, but also for battle,
mm-hmm.
Be it individual battle or be it group battle. The Maasai, they use the acacias, you know. And so they're not all mushrooms. Some are different, but the mushroom is used to not only for hunting, but also for martial prowess and martial knowledge, information, and understanding. And many of the martial arts styles that we see are downloaded through the through the mushroom access points into the human realm. So even if you're talking about Shaolin Kung Fu, or you're talking about Aikido, or you're talking about ninjutsu, things that are more popular in the public domain, they all had in their inception, some still carry that, but others have in modern times let that thing go. They all had their entheogens that became part, I mean, that were part of how these things were, as I said earlier, downloaded into the human realm. That's how you get in Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon, you know, where the guys are flying and jumping up to the top of trees and things like that. That's all entheogenic battle, where one warrior would take his entheogen, the other warrior would take his entheogen, and they'd battle on the transdimensional, hyperdimensional realms rather than in the physical. That way, no one has a physical death, but they go through the movements, and in that realm, they have the ability to do all of those different types of things, to jump to the top of trees and to block 1,000 arrows with their sword and things like that. That was all done under the ingestion of those particular power plants, and you know, some were alchemies, others were straight up the pure singular mushroom, but others were alchemies with the acacia and with the rue. And then you have places like Sri Lanka and Indonesia, you know, which are into the Daturas and things like that in the martial arts of Silat and things like that. Also mushrooms, you know, were all part of that whole compendium information that was in Southeast Asia, you know, and it goes all the way back to the Vedic literature, you know, dealing with, you know, Soma and Somaraja, which, you know, Gordon Watson said that Soma was Amanita muscaria, but, you know, there were many different somas and soma formulas for different things. I think they say there were 107 somas and one soma raja, which was the king soma, five of which were mushrooms that were the male portion of it, and the other 101 were female plants that were mixed together with soma raja, which was the Syrian rue or African rue that has a different configuration inside of it, as opposed to like the ayahuasca, which has the you know, the harmines and harmalas in it. But the rues have the harmine and harmala, but they also have the pinealine, and the pinealine was done in was a secretion of the pineal gland, and also part of the dark room technology that was part of the learning. Many martial arts were learned in total darkness. It's kind of like dream yoga or dream soma accumulation by being in the dark for 7, 14, 21, 49 days. And you had certain monasteries that lived underground in total darkness, and Labyrinths and things like that, that practiced on inside of mountains and things like that. You know, and then they built artificial mountains such as the Merkut, which is the pyramids and things like that. But Labyrinth cave systems and things like that were where entheogenic practice happened, where they'd go down and through the ingestion of tryptophan, you know, dense foods, have what they call endowasca or endogenous ayahuasca that would, or endosoma, which was endogenous utilization of these particular chemicals that are endogenous and exogenous, but the endogenous ones accumulate in darkness. And then on top of that, not only doing your practice, postures, martial arts, spiritual learning, sojourns into the multiverse, into the different libraries and things like that, you also have the ingestion on top of that of DMTs that were done in darkness to give you kind of like the booster rocket,
mm-hmm.
you know, and then what happens from there is in the world that you go into, the mushroom world or the DMT world or whatever you want to call it, the hyperdimensional, transdimensional worlds, mm-hmm. you also have entheogens out there also that mm-hmm. you can go places where they're, once you get there, they're taking entheogens to go further into the multiverse.
Very interesting.
So you know, especially with the jinn or the genies coming out of Persia, mm-hmm. you know, things like that, they're always smoking something up there. You know.
Yeah. What do you think your martial arts practice has taught you about being a parent?
Well, you know, martial art is about self-defense first and foremost. People try to make it a lot of other things, but first and foremost, it's about protection. So when you're a martial artist or a warrior, you understand how to be in front of those things that would be harmful to your children. So martial art is just not punching and kicking. It's knowing the proper food, just knowing to which GMOs to stay away from. You know, it's a all-inclusive lifestyle that is based upon warrior action, warrior understanding, and being able to deal with whatever is thrown at you from whatever direction. And that goes into, of course, protecting your most precious relationships, which are, you know, your family, your children and grandchildren, and things like that. So that's what martial arts is really about for me. You know, at this point, I'm not worried about jumping on anybody or anybody jumping on me or fighting six cops. And well, that may happen, but I'm just saying, it's about protection, about protecting your family, about giving them the right education to live in the world. Giving them self-defense training, because, you know, my children have all had self-defense training from me, from growing up in the martial arts school. Some have adopted it as something that they continue to do. Others, you know, that's just the thing that they grew up with. Mm-hmm. But, you know, I wouldn't, you know, even the ones that don't practice now, they grew up doing nothing else.
Mm-hmm.
And I wouldn't want to just grab them haphazardly, you know, while they're walking down the street, just to grab somebody,
right?
You know, it's part of their being. That's what their mother and father did. Mm-hmm. You know, that was our world: mm-hmm. entheogens, martial arts, things like that.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So, oh, I lost track of my questions a second.
Good point. No problem. Yeah. It's about, you know, so it's about, you know, keeping things rolling in life, you know, understanding finance so that you don't starve to death, you know, those type of things. So that's mm-hmm. what martial art is, not just, you know.
Are you still there?
No.
Oh.
Jumping up, kicking people, things like that. It's
yeah.
about really holding down a life. Yeah, I'm still there.
Yeah. So one of the things that the first person I interviewed when I started doing this work was Dennis McKenna. And I was interested in one thing that he was talking about is, you know, he lives in Minneapolis. He's lived there for many years. And I was curious because I was, you know, living in Lansing and not really feeling like I had much in the way of like local community. And I had asked him a question about finding community. And he said, well, you know, you just have to kind of like make community where you are. And I'm interested in, how you have made community around the mushrooms in Detroit, and then also in Cincinnati with Kai's work.
Cleveland with Kai's work. Yeah.
Oh, Cleveland. I'm
well,
sorry.
The,
yes.
The thing is, yeah, yeah. Well, the thing is that you know, we have put together these conferences to start to expand the knowledge of that there are other people in the area to. Mm-hmm. you know, let folks know, because the biggest thing is finding folks, because, you know, folks don't really just advertise, you know, hey, we, you know, we, when are we going to get together and get, you know, talk about DMT or talk about mushrooms or talk about acid and things like that. So the conference is a nexus point of where people can come and say, oh yeah, well, there are the people in the, you know, this person lives in my neighborhood. I never knew, you know, things like that, that there were other people around. So now that things are opening up around the world with the different conferences, of course, which you, many of which you attend and many of which you participate in as a, you know, as a speaker and lecturer and things like that, that, you know, it's just about really getting things going in your town, getting things going in your area, you know, having meetups and, you know, helping to get together and plan the conferences and things like that. So that's really where it's spreading. And as people, more and more people go in, you know, they want to share. So that's really how, you know, I've been dealing with spreading things around and getting things going as far as, you know, the community building efforts in Detroit. It was basically the same in Cleveland with Kai and the mushroom farm there. And also, you know, there will be a woman's another woman's conference there next year. Those things that could continue after, you know, after Kai passed earlier this year, people have stepped to the mantle and said, we're going to keep this thing going. So
that's excellent.
The community there is, you know, has reached out and things are still moving, you know, of course, slower because Kai was the moving factor and all of that, but you know, other people are stepping up, and you know, the women's conference will go on.
And you know, one of the things that you had been telling me about Kai's work was in regards to helping women and people in the inner city who had experienced either sexual violence or just the general violence that can come from living in a place with not a lot of options and poverty. And I'm really interested in your experience of what kinds of healings have occurred in Detroit, for example, in your communities, through mushrooms that, you know, maybe people, like maybe white folks are not, don't have to, the kind of things that white folks don't have to deal with.
Well, I mean, we can take, for instance, one of the people who are part of our entheogenic sojourns, you know, had been taking mushrooms for, you know, quite a little while now. And, you know, as we take entheogens, mushrooms, whatever, we start reading the literature and the surrounding things and what's going on other places, you know. So you read the John Hopkins study, you read the things that are coming out of London and out of Australia and the work that MAPS is doing and things like that. So a lot of, well, not a lot, but a few of the people in Detroit have started to say, well, hey, if MAPS is doing a study on, you know, you know, getting a smoking cessation or, you know, dealing with stage four cancer, anxiety, and all of these different types of things. You know, what about my cousin who is a crack addict? What could this do for him? You know, or certainly it can't hurt because, you know, mushrooms are very safe physically. Psychologically, you know, if a person, their only goal is to deal with their crack addiction minute by minute, moment by moment, what could this do to help them? So several of the people have dealt with those type of life challenges. You know, a friend in 1 7-gram dose of psilocybin mushrooms has gotten his cousin off of crack.
Wow. Cocaine. That's awesome.
And he's been since that time. I don't know whether it's been a year and a half or 2 years or something like that. I can't remember exactly what the time range has been, but he hasn't went back. Mm-hmm. He got a second dose and basically became the head of his family. He went from the person that, if you have a family gathering that he, okay, raised in the house, we have to watch the silverware type thing.
Yeah.
To being the actual, he's taken up the reins, got a job, taken up the reins of being the head of his family. And this has happened in more than one occasion that things like this, that, we didn't have any, we didn't have any access to Ibogaine or, sure. Other things other than just the regular, Addicts Anonymous or, Drug Addicts Anonymous and things like that. So people have taken it on their own under their own auspices to say, hey, well, what can be done with this thing? And, my loved one who has a difficult problem that they're trying to deal with. And, others who have worked their way through sexual trauma, with these things. And, it's been just people sharing and helping without, without advertising it, without letting people, the sentries know, just going and saying, hey, give me a Saturday night. You take these mushrooms and you tell me what you think after it's over with. You set an intention of that I want to explore and conquer why this thing happened. Why am I doing this? Why am I addicted to this substance?
Mm-hmm.
And mushrooms will do anything that any of the other entheogens do.
Mm-hmm.
At high dose mushrooms is DMT.
Mm-hmm.
I've never taken 5-MeO DMT toad medicine, mm-hmm. but I believe I would postulate from my experiences with mushrooms at different doses that it will deliver the same type of experience at the right dose.
Mm-hmm.
It'll do what salvia divinorum does. It'll do what acid does. It'll do what ketamine does. It'll do any of those things at the proper dose. It's very dose specific. The mm-hmm. difficulty with mushrooms is that most people have never had an entheogenic experience with mushrooms because they've never taken enough to get to that point to where they can access those different dimensions of what that mushroom has inside of it and its relationship to the human consciousness.
Mm-hmm.
So, yes, those are the type of things that are going on with just regular people in the city of Detroit and the city of Cleveland
mm-hmm.
who says, oh, my son was raped by his uncle from the time he was 8 years old till he was 14 years old.
Mm-hmm.
He has difficulty with that. He's having difficulty with his sexuality, and not getting into whether, a person's choice as far as sexuality. He's having trauma with his sexuality because of being raped between right. 7 and 14,
mm-hmm.
who have taken it, and his mother or his brother or others have brought this particular compound to him to work his way through that. What happened the first time? Why did it happen? And to understand that ultimately it wasn't his fault and not his choice. He was imposed upon by an outside force.
Mm-hmm.
So these type of things are how people are working their way through and walking their way through and generally coming out on the positive end of those type of things.
Mm-hmm.
The young man who had never had a relationship with a woman because of that male sexual trauma that was upon him,
mm-hmm.
who now has a wife and baby and is living a pretty much normal life, if you can call anything normal in this day and age.
Right.
But he's living a pretty much normal life now, who has the relationship with a nice young woman and baby because of what he gained from the insight of being able to deal with these mushrooms and have them deliver a area of consciousness that is novel to the general way that we deal with trauma.
Uh-huh. I'm interested in going into a little bit, because one of the things that you and I have talked about in private and in public forums before is, you know, I have had also some healing from addiction through ayahuasca, but as I've been in your presence and kind of thought about some different things, one of the things that you have been arguing pretty often is that mushrooms are the best substance for, say, North Americans or people from the U.S. And it ties into what you were saying about access. So I'd like to hear, like you to share maybe a little bit about your thoughts on that for our listeners. As opposed to ayahuasca or something else.
Yeah. Well, ayahuasca, I think, is a wonderful compound. I think the ayahuasca tourist industry that is being built around it is, I think that's a problem.
Mm-hmm.
I think that, you know, it's not really sustainable as more and more people try to experience this from around the world. You know, of course, people are growing, you know, are trying in certain areas to grow it. And that's a good thing.
Mm-hmm.
But as far as sustainability, you know, with mushrooms, you know, mushrooms are kind of like, you know, you can grow mushrooms in your kitchen cupboard, in your closet, mm-hmm. in your bathroom, in the basement, in a spare closet in your home.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you're not going to be growing vines and bushes and things like that in your home. And what right. if you're in Michigan or Wisconsin or, you know, Vancouver or whatever, right. you know, you don't, you, to have access to an entheogen that's powerful to not only deal with exploration, but for the healing of certain people and for your consciousness,
mm-hmm.
mushrooms are perfect because all you have to do is go through a small learning curve of, say, the PF technique. You know, if you're not, mushrooms don't lend itself to large scale production, you know,
right.
so no, don't be no drug lord or anything like that, you know, you know, and make $1 million selling mushrooms and things
right.
like that, you know. Some people work their way through school with it during the '70s out of the closet.
Uh-huh.
But you know, people thinking, well, I'm going to get some mushrooms, I'm going to sell a bunch of mushrooms to be a millionaire, things like that. That just doesn't happen.
Right.
Because mushrooms is too much work to get enough for yourself and maybe to share with a friend.
Right.
So mushrooms is very sustainable as a entheogen, that can be utilized by the common person. Everybody
sure.
doesn't have $2,800 to go down to Peru or Brazil or whatever.
Right.
Not everybody wants to join a church, you know, the Santo Daime or something like that. Nobody, mm-hmm. everybody doesn't want to do that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so it's really sustainable that you can grow it on a variety of different things. You can grow it on a horse or a cow, manure.
Mm-hmm.
You can grow it on coco core. You can mm-hmm. grow it on straw. You know,
mm-hmm.
all of these type of things that are very accessible in our environment gives us the ability to be able to control our own destiny as far as you know, as far as power plants and entheogens go.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and the thing about mushrooms is that mushrooms really don't lend itself as much to the social group thing.
Mm-hmm.
It's more of an individual thing.
Mm-hmm.
Ayahuasca, you know, you have the shaman songs. You have those people who sit around in a group setting and
mm-hmm.
purge as a group and singing as a group and commune as a group.
Mm-hmm.
And not that mushrooms don't do that because, mm-hmm. you know, you have groups that do mushroom ceremonies. Monica Crumbut, which reminds me of her, and
mm-hmm.
Cape in the Cape in South Africa.
You right.
know, she has ceremonies all of the time, you mm-hmm. know, with groups. And, you know, and she's had a little difficulty with that because one person in one of her groups walked out the gate, walked down the street to the police station and said,
yeah.
hey, they doing a mushroom ceremony. ceremony down the street.
Right.
So, you know, but some people are in around the world are doing ceremonies with mushrooms.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so mushrooms are sustainable. It's something you can do. Keep your mouth shut. Use your old closet. Advertise. Don't sell. Share with a friend or two, or those people in your family, and it's sustainable. And the thing about mushrooms is that if you get one spore print or one syringe, you never have to buy anything again. It can be self perpetuated. You could actually use the same pack. You could actually use the same pack of jars for years.
Right. Right. Yeah.
Before you had to get another $8 pack of jars, you know,
right.
If you're just going for yourself.
Uh-huh.
So it's very cheap to do. You don't have to travel anywhere. You don't have to buy a bunch of expensive equipment. You don't have to worry about trying to grow a tree or anything like mm-hmm. that. It's very sustainable in that you're using waste products to grow, and it's just a very, very good way to be able to journey at your own leisure, in your own time, in your own environment, and, you know, not have a lot of hassle that goes along with it.
Mm-hmm. And I'd have to say that from my perspective, there's very few things on earth that are more rewarding than cultivating this other plant, this other being in your home, watching it grow from nothing, and then consuming it and having this powerful spiritual experience. I remember the first time that I did mushrooms, and it was ones that I had grown myself, and it just felt like this beautiful circle.
Yeah, well, definitely, definitely. It's you have a relationship with the mushroom spirit, as mm-hmm. they say.
Mm-hmm.
You know, by growing your own. I think that's the best way. I think that, you know, you should learn to grow your own. And in doing that, you cultivate them, you set your intention with them, you tell them, don't take me any place crazy, but that usually doesn't work.
Right, yes, no, no.
Or at some point they'll add, they'll show you all the beautiful things, and then eventually they'll say, well, let me show you this. You want it? I want to show you this, you know, so... it's a conversation, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
Back and forth. It's a dynamic that you and the mushrooms have that is a real relationship.
Yeah,
you know, it's a real relationship, and it's different from going down to Peru where someone else has picked the vine, and someone else has cooked the vine, and someone else has put their intention and things into it. And then you're going with a bunch of people, which, you know, in my experience with entheogens, anytime that there's somebody else there, you always hook into their trip, even though you may not be, you know, there's times that you just can't help from the energies converging, you know. So mm-hmm. I think mushrooms are a way to go, you know. Mm-hmm. Or the way to go.
Mm-hmm. Well, speaking back on building relationships and community, why don't you tell us a little more about what you have in store for folks on Halloween weekend at the Detroit Entheogenic Conference?
Well, the October 28th, 29th, and 30th, the holiday weekend, we'll be at the First Unitarian Church down on Cass and Forest. In the historic Cass Corridor community, close to Wayne State there mm-hmm. in the city of Detroit. And we'll be having 3 days of a journey. And we're bringing in so many of the dense minds inside of this whole entheogenic thing. It won't just be mushrooms. It'll be ibogaine. It'll be LSD. It'll be your DMTs, mushrooms, the plethora of different types of compounds will be talked about. Mm-hmm. There'll be workshops, and we're pulling together a film for Saturday evening. And so it'll be a chance for folks who usually don't get a chance to go to Vancouver or go to California or go to Prague or wherever. It'll be right in the city of Detroit. So if you're in Chicago or if you're in Wisconsin or wherever, you're close to Detroit, in the Detroit area, to be able to come down and spend the weekend and get real crucial information about these things from people who have experience in these areas, you know, not just, you know, talking about it or listening to a YouTube video and things like that, and be able to ask your questions, be able to find other people in your area for community if that's what you want to do. So we're going to have a wonderful time. Our last conference in 2014 was a success. You know, it brought together people from as far away as London, you know, Florida, you know, I mean, people came from all over because, you know, Detroit isn't the psychedelic place of what I guess people would say Detroit. Sure. You think of psychedelic, you say, so, well, San Francisco or New, you know, the Village in New York and things like that, you know.
Right.
Detroit really wasn't on the map as far as that's concerned. But here we have a chance in a nice, safe environment to be able to come and look at these things. Now, this is about psychedelics. It's not all psychedelics in the sense that we're going to be sitting around utilizing.
Right. Yes, yes, yes.
That's not what this conference is about. It's about information. It's about communion. It's about coming together and sharing. That's really what it's about.
Yeah,
it's going to be a great conference.
Right on.
Also, you'll be speaking there also. So, you know, we're having a lot of people who, like, as I said, have experience and have adopted this entheogenic area as a big part of their lifestyle.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so we'll be there.
Yeah, there's a few people on the confirmed speakers so far who are folks that maybe people haven't heard of before. I'm interested in, maybe you could tell us about a couple of the speakers that are confirmed that maybe folks haven't heard of and we can get excited about.
Well, we have Brother Dooley, who's from the Boston area. He's called the Beantown Shaman.
Yeah,
he's not only a very knowledgeable and experienced shamanistic and entheogenic sojourner, but his sense of humor and understanding of how these things affect community, and basically the urban communities and things like that. He'll be speaking. We have Dimitri, who is a native Detroiter. Who will be speaking on Ibogaine and dealing with substance abuse. And that's really his area because he was a drug user right there in the Cass Corridor. And what brought him out of it was Ibogaine. So he'll be coming back home.
Nice.
Right within a quarter mile radius of where, you know, he spent a large part of his life dealing with substance abuse and substance abusers, and how he's now in New York. I believe he's in the Bronx, a center there dealing with substance abuse and getting people off of opiates and other addictive substances. So he'll be speaking. I'll be speaking. You'll be speaking. We'll have Brother Mudubaki, who basically just gave such a surrounding and inclusive lecture at the Breaking Convention Conference that I myself, and it's just my personal opinion, I say that it was the best lecture of the Breaking Convention Conference. You know, he'll be speaking. We'll be having other folks. It was just going to be a great time.
Right on.
A great time.
Yeah, we're very excited to come and to have it be so close to home and bring some some close local friends in that that you know know of my work, but haven't maybe had a chance to go to a conference like this, because you know it's for most folks it's a challenge to say go to New York City just for the weekend or go to Vancouver or Southern California or something like that. So this is this is great for the Midwest.
Yeah, definitely. You know, because you know I've went as far as the outback of Australia to different conferences, you know, so most people can't, you know, most people just can't do that. Or they could do it if they planned for it and wanted to, but how did it just justify, you know, flying 20 hours to Australia and walking across the outback, staying a week and then coming back. If you're a teacher and it's school time, you know, that type of thing.
Exactly.
So, being right here in Detroit, you know, folks can, you know, folks in the surrounding area, you know, Chicago, Wisconsin, Ohio, Indiana, stuff like that, can all come and be a part of it. We have a, if you Google the first Detroit Entheogenic Conference, it'll bring up the website. We're also on, I'm on Facebook, you know, Kalindi Iyi. You can get me on Facebook and also through the website, email address and things like that. So,
and we'll have links to, all that stuff on the program notes. So people will be able to access that.
Okay. Very good.
So just, we have about five more minutes and, you know, you mentioned a couple of folks, Dooley, who I've had on the show before, and Dimitri, who are good friends of mine as well as yours. And you know, one of the things that I asked Dooley, and one of the things that Dimitri brought up in New York City at a recent event, was about the tendency towards these sort of psychedelic conversations and events and stuff to be pretty white. And, you know, as a leader in this community and a person of color, I'm interested in, what your opinion is on how white folks can, you know, make people of color feel more welcome in these communities, and also maybe why people of color, feel like they aren't a part of these communities, perhaps.
Well, I mean, it's a prejudice that goes back to the 60s as far as entheogens are concerned. Most people of color feel that psychedelics, LSD, mushrooms, and things like that, number one, is a white thing, and we don't get into it. Number two, the areas that are basically embracing entheogens, psychedelics, hallucinogenics at this particular time are the academic areas. So many times when you see conferences in Amsterdam or Prague or things like that, you basically see middle-aged white men. Now you have a younger crop coming in, so you have younger PhDs and things like that. They have a few token women. And for many years, you'd have a all-white cast and Kalindi Iyi. I went to, went to Basel, Switzerland for the big LSD conference with Albert Hoffman there
for his 100th birthday,
his honoring and stuff like that and things like that. And you'll have 2,000 people there and actually no people of color, black people at all, except for me.
Yeah.
So I was really the pioneer. And I'm not, you know, there are other, of course, people who have been there and pioneered, but I consider myself one of the pioneers in dealing with this as far as being a black person from the United States, being there and finally breaching and bridging the gap of being able to sit on these panels and be in the conferences and things like that. Because for a long time, it was just basically all middle-aged white guy thing, you know, because many of them in their fields are marginalized in their fields, you know. Not a lot of these people are, you know, they're in the psychiatry or psychology, and they, you know, they may be writing papers or books or something like that, but nobody's buying their books, and they're not on Time magazine because they've come up with some new area of research or things like that. So this is a way to be able to be invited to the wine and cheese parties, to be able to go to exotic places, to be able to be looked upon as the expert. And then I feel that there's really no experts in the entheogenic field. You know, mm-hmm. we're all groping in the dark and trying to learn and trying to understand. So there's no experts. I'm no expert. I have questions, not answers. You know, I'm saying, what, you know, I'm out here like everybody else. But the thing is that I share a particular niche inside of this thing. Mm-hmm. And it's not really a popular niche, mm-hmm. because many of the white professors, PhDs, things like that, want an approach that is basically clinical, and they want an approach that is basically, you know, what they would deem a safe way presenting this to the public through academia, mm-hmm. you know, through mm-hmm. the colleges and through different hospitals and things like that, universities. Mm-hmm. Whereas I'm a proponent of the self-explorer, mm-hmm. the lone traveler, that a person has the sovereign right to do this, not for the purposes of just healing, but the purposes of self-exploration of consciousness. Mm-hmm. And whether that person's a 16-year-old boy who's got a YouTube video and a sports syringe who starts growing his mother in his mother's basement and starts experimenting on Saturday nights going into the multiverse, or whether that person is a 70-year-old grandmother who says that mushrooms changed her life and that she's going to have in her backyard mushroom ceremonies that she doesn't care who knows about. that if she's caught by the police and they said, hey, this mushroom thing, you're a granny, we have to try you because that's the law. Mm-hmm. But this mushroom thing, you have to stop. And as soon as they let her out, the next weekend, she has another ceremony. She says, screw you guys. Because right. this is my right to be able to do it. Now, if yeah. you want to prosecute a 70-year-old granny in court, I'm ready to go. I'm ready to go against you. You can. Mm-hmm. What are you going to do to me? You know. So, I'm the person who says, you know, that people should have the right to do it without asking you, mm-hmm. or you giving it to them. Mm-hmm. And I'm the person that says that we haven't taken the doses that we need to take to be able to access this thing. So you guys are not taking enough. You're not giving enough to your people. Right. You're not experiencing it yourself. I'm saying taking 30 and 40 grams of mushrooms, which is absolutely unheard of right. In the genre, other than other people who adopted, who were taking you know, 3.5 grams or 5 grams and things like that. And they come across my YouTube video and say, hey, well, I want to take 40 grams too. And hopefully they don't jump out and take 40 grams, that they move incrementally and responsibly uh-huh. through this thing. Because I didn't just, you know, even though I had a dose comparable to that the first time, but when I started to study and to understand, I took it step by step. I didn't mm-hmm. just jump into 40 grams. You mm-hmm. take it step by step mm-hmm. and you move slow. Yeah. It's a marathon, not a sprint. You know? So these are the type of things that I talk about, and it creates friction, you know, in these conferences and other things. You right. know, it's like, oh, this guy's coming. He's going to be. We're saying that you shouldn't take more than, you know,
3.5 grams.
Yeah. 5 grams or 3.5 grams is, you know, nobody on earth needs more than that. And you know, I got people, you know, I got people taking more than me from looking at my old YouTube videos. They Facebook messaging me like, I've taken 45 grams this time. And, you know, wow. I'm like, okay, well, you tell me. I don't know, because I've taken 45 grams. You tell me what's going on.
Wow.
So, you know, it's about really looking at the angle that I'm at. It's uh-huh. a different niche from the academia, and that's where we go into. So it's basically, like I said, run and control the white middle-aged PhD, psychiatrist, psychologist, professor, anthropologist controlled thing. Mm-hmm. And they have access to the universities and things. So mm-hmm. that's where they're keeping it. And black people and other people of color look at this as something that is a white thing, remnants of the hippies of the 1960s, mm-hmm. you know, I don't want to get into that. I don't want to be running around naked or lose my mind or jump out the window or any of those things that, you know, that are associated through the propaganda mill of the war on drugs from mm-hmm. Richard Nixon and, you know, and others who put this thing together to make it seem like it's something crazy when it is the most natural and pristine way of understanding the human consciousness that was ever experienced.
Mm-hmm. Amen. So on that, Lundy, we've come to the end of our hour, and I would like to thank you so much for being a part of this community, continuing to shake things up in the world of bald, white, middle-class Americans. And speaking as a bald, middle-class white American, yeah.
Thank you for having me, and I'll see you in Prague.
We'll be there, man. We'll be there. All right.
Thank you. Bye.
My advice is to learn from your children, and perhaps eventually, when you're spiritually ready, you'll turn on with your children if you think that's the right thing to do.
Your ties and your friends and your associations.